Hello. Here we are in the most tensely wound pre-election week that I can remember in the United States, in which all of the neurons in this corner of humanity's species-wide nervous system are entirely co-opted by the structures of political engagement and controversy. The most important single activity that all of that involves for each of us, the ones gathered in this place that does not exist together, is that if you are a citizen of this democracy with an entitlement to vote, you need to make a plan to vote. I look out the other windows of my apartment at the corner of 125th Street and Broadway, where early voting is now going on, and I see the lines of people whose plan it is to vote early and to wait online to do it. I hope my vantage will allow me to slip in at some moment when it's not quite so crowded, but it is a pleasure of a special kind in a democratic society to wait online to vote. And so, even in the middle of an epidemic, I would like to have that particular pleasure, and I hope that you will too. When so many people want to vote that they must line up and see one another engaged in waiting to rule themselves, something useful passes from eye to eye and mind to mind that would be worth taking even a little bit of risk about the virus in order to do. So let's review briefly where we are in a conversation about the pipe businesses, the telecommunications service providers, and how we went from Mother Bell to the parasite with the mind of God. Our interest in the telecommunications system, narrowly so called, is not only about the prehistory, the paleontology of the parasite, though that's a very important part of it. It is also about the regulatory framework, that is the legal vocabulary and processes with which this and other similarly highly developed societies allowed themselves to be enwrapped first in the lines of control of the telecommunications oligopolists, and then through them underwent an injection of the nuclear material of the parasite with the mind of God. So let's review how this happened. Once upon a time, in the era of Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, there was the possibility of using electrical conduction to create circuit-switched networks over which voice signals from the speech of human beings could pass, rather than the Morse code of the telegraph network, which is, of course, not even circuit-switched, unswitched, merely switched on and off through a binary pulse modulation, which was what made it possible to build the railroads and to extend both the American Republic and the Russian Empire across continental reaches of imagined empty space. The circuit switch network of the 20th century produced the telephone company, a form of supposedly natural monopoly conducted as a regulated public utility, but with enormous profitability amounting to a system of farmed taxation, that is, through various forms of development and bribery and political influence, the telephone monopoly, said to be natural, turned the society around it into a condition in which the taxes that it paid and the favors that it did were the offset that allowed it to earn the enormous profits of a private taxation system for the necessary facility we call the telephone bill. The circuit switched oligopolists or natural monopolists of the 20th century telephone system had enormous revenues out of which to research the incremental improvement of their networks. Like monopolists, they didn't want to improve too much, certainly not enough to create fundamental opportunities for competition. Yet, on the other hand, like the Bell Laboratories, which were the greatest research entities that the telecommunication system ever created anywhere, they produced the transistor, for which John Bardeen and colleagues at the Bell System won a Nobel Prize, and discovered by the microwave background radiation of the Big Bang that changed cosmology forever and won another group of Bell researchers and their colleagues in the physical sciences a Nobel Prize, and produced the great software innovations that led, as we have seen through Unix, to GNU and Linux in the free software world, among many other fundamental achievements. But the transistor and the digital switching systems that it produced, that it accumulated into, that you could say like the microorganisms of the Precambrian period, they complexified themselves into, those systems of digital switching that the transistor made possible also enabled the rise not of the circuit switched telephone system but of the packet switched internet, which gave birth both to competition, because the telecommunications providers were merely one set of piping companies with now one set of otherwise easily duplicable switches. In other words, there was no natural monopoly of any kind anymore. The copper wires under the street were competing with the coaxial cables on the poles, which were competing with the various forms of electromagnetic spectrum carriage, all of which had the characteristic that in the architecture of our ARPA, then internet, the packet switch network in which packets could be anything, any carrier could do the work of any other carrier, no pipe had a competitive or natural advantage in a technical sense, and all sorts of pipes could be constructed on the basis of all sorts of internal political economies of carriage. And at the same time, telephony became merely moving voice signals once digitized around, which was easy to do for any kind of switch over any kind of pipe, and there wasn't anything special about being the telephone company anymore. This, the system of converging oligopolists with no natural monopolies behind them, so-called natural monopolies behind them anymore, gave rise to the condition at the beginning of the 21st century that I described last time in the words of the chief technical officer of a previously national, now liberalized telecommunications giant, that no one will make money moving bits in the 21st century. Which caused these greatly powerful and well politically connected entities to have to seek for some form in which their existing clout could be turned into their future clout, which led them through the experiments with the ownership and distribution of the content, the brutal friendship partnership of those who make Hollywood and those who transmit it, Which experiment had the difficulty that the players in that game, giants though they were, had no natural ability to bring the combat to an end in their own favor in these great Godzilla versus Predator versus Alien versus kinds of shows. There wasn't any way for that brutal friendship to resolve itself. When Mussolini and Hitler had what Mussolini referred to as the brutal friendship, there was an answer in the end about who the ultimately stronger was. But over this past generation of constant seesaw effort by carriage and content to merge and control the other, there is no apparent natural saddle point in the game, no equilibrium at which either the one or the other can safely triumph. And indeed, the whole thing turned out, with the rise of the platform companies, to be something of an obsolete struggle anyway. This is the condition in which we found ourselves in the last decade watching as the telecommunications service providers, those packet switch network operators who were at risk of being turned into wholesale carriers of patents, just common carriers of packets, nothing more than the forms of transport characteristic of the time. There's nothing wrong, of course, with being a common carrier. The transportation businesses, the logistics and shippers and railway expresses of the world were fine businesses between the onset of the railroad and the end of the automobile. But to be a common carrier, to have to take whatever it is and move it from wherever it is to wherever it's going without looking inside or making any transformations or discriminating on the basis of who it was who shipped it or what business they were in, this process of being a common carrier was what the telecommunications service providers understood to be their death, the condition in which no one made money moving bids. It came for reasons that had to do with the PR shrewdness of one local telecommunications operator and one not-so-shrewd law professor. It turned out that this conversation about whether, in the end, the telecommunications service providers, the big pipes, companies of the 20th century should become carriers. This conversation turned out to be conducted under the terrible misunderstanding-laden phrase network neutrality. This idea, network neutrality, was offered as a poisoned pawn by, as I say, a shrewd telecommunications executive and his PR advisors, who understood that if the other side, the pro-common carriage side, picked it up and used it, it would cause intolerable confusion, which it did. In the first place, the desire of the telecommunications network operators not to be common carriers, not to have to take whatever was put in at the edge of pipe A and deliver it at pipe B without discriminatory regard to what it was or who had sent it, without the ability to look inside the packet, without the opportunity to spy on what was going on. That image of the telecommunications future didn't really have anything to do with the pipes at all. What the telecommunications service providers needed to do, as the CTO of France Telecom become Orange knew in 2005, what the CTO knew and what the companies like that people like him work for knew they needed to do was not to emphasize the role of the pipes in their business. The pipes constituted an immense part of their investment, all that cabling, all that electric power being put to use through all those digital means. But just because that was a large part of their investment didn't mean that it was a large part of their profit. The whole point about being infrastructure companies, indeed, was that their investments and their profits had always been earned in different places. Instead, what the telecommunications service providers, the oligopolists who had previously been about piping, needed was to make switching the part of their business which generated profit, even after switches were no longer being rented by the instant. The economics left over from their period of offering telephone calls and charging by the impulse or by the minute, the model of the economics left over from their past was that customers should pay for switching conducted over expensive piping, which was already or would soon be fully amortized, so that switch rental revenue was really where all the profit in the business was. But in a network of packets rather than circuits, the way your switches make you money is by allowing you to discriminate among things moving over the pipes and changing the pricing according to what is being shipped. This is what the France Telecom Orange CTO meant when he said that his image of the telecommunications profit stream of future was the delivery of premium content to homes and businesses, that is to say, bits that you moved and charged more for because of what wonderful bits they were. And this is, of course, requires that the shipper be able to discriminate and charge more for the moving of diamonds per pound than the moving of coal dust per pound. But that depends upon the determination by the society not to do with respect to the shipping of bits what it had been doing with respect to the shipping of everything else, pretty much, generation by generation, between the 15th century and the 20th. That is to say, to create regulatory structures in which those who carry have to take what's offered up to their capacity to ship it, and they have to bring it according to weight by mile or some other form of standard pricing, which does not allow them to take advantage of their constant, supposedly naturally monopolistic role as middlemen in order to extort a tax upon each form of property or value that they move. Really, then, what was described as the fight over network neutrality would more appropriately and usefully have been described as the fight over discriminatory routing. It is the switch's ability to look inside and to know, and therefore to price accordingly, which becomes the first great legal discussion, or shall we say a political discussion, or shall we say a discussion which demonstrates that there is never really any difference between controversies in this area over law and politics and technology, it's always all of them, which occurred in the developed societies over the course of the period from roughly the beginning of the 21st century to roughly its 14th or 15th year. In the United States, as with so many other subjects of the time, the matter became one which was binary and polarized between political parties. Though the telecommunications oligopolists had always proceeded in the United States under the assumption that they could all capture government together, though a White House guy once described to me, a specialist in this area of policy, once described the FCC in a conversation he and I were having as the single most captured administrative entity of American government, which is true, but also a big thing to say, given how much regulatory capture the American government can stand. But the telecommunications oligopolists had always assumed that if they all owned the FCC together, their internecine competitive strife could be conducted under terms that would allow them to fight as much as they wanted without endangering one another's control of the machinery of regulatory government. In other of the major societies in the European Union's various national regimes, and in Japan and in Korea, this process played out in different and not necessarily geometrically more complicated ways. But in the United States, it came to be the case that the Democratic Party supported the idea of making the telecommunications service providers into common carriers, and the Republican Party did not. And the Democratic Party was prepared to undertake a process which was likely to cause it to lose substantial support from what had previously been important ownership interests in American government. But in order to do that, it had to cultivate a willingness to deal instead with the platform companies, and it is relevant that the same Obama administration, which grew more committed to network neutrality over time, so-called, by which we mean common carriage and non-discriminatory routing practices in the regulation of the telecommunications service industries, the Obama administration, which came to be more and more committed to non-discriminatory routing, also ate lunch more and more frequently at the White House with Google. When in the second Obama administration, the Google lunches were essentially conducted weekly, the commitment to the common carriage view of the telecommunications service platforms companies had become almost equally frequently reaffirmed. The dispute over discriminatory routing, however, can in itself be seen as a kind of transitional stage from the economics of switch rental in a world of telephony, as it shifted from circuit switching to packet switching, from that world of you used to be a telephone company, now you are a packet mover, you will not discriminate among the things you carry unless the other party is in power, and in any event, the FCC is still there to make you profitable and to protect you from anti-oligopolistic theories of how to use the technology, so far as it can, by regulatory intervention, do so. But in the end, of course, it turns out that the way to make the switch profitable is not primarily by discriminating on the basis of whose packets are being carried and what they contain, although there is still, at least in theory, a gold mine's worth of satisfaction in discriminating in favor of your own content packets, making your own deals with the Hollywoods and Bollywoods of the world, and especially zapping forward their stuff to people for a surcharge. The real money in the switches was the opportunity to look inside the packets and to observe the behavior of the human beings whose computers were receiving those packets and sending a few clicks to buy and clicks to know and clicks just to prove how much you like things back up the pipe. In other words, in the end, the thing which turned out to be most objectionable about the role of the common carrier in the long history of the law of regulation of transport, the thing that turned out to be most objectionable about the common carrier's way of being wasn't the inability to discriminate about price per pound per mile based on what was shipped. The most important rule turned out to be the rule made in what we called Carrier's case in the 1470s, that you can't break bulk, that is, open the wrapper, that is, look inside the package. That turned out to be the most important rule, because the real profitability in switching turned out to be to spy on what was sent. Breaking bulk, looking inside the packet, what the technology of routing refers to as deep packet inspection, that's what actually turned out to be where all the money was. After all, that was how the platform companies did it. We need to think of this once again in relation to the fundamental transformation of the most highly developed, wealthy economies in the world, the ones where consumption became the bulk of the gross domestic product, the whole of the economy, in the biased way that the whole is established by economists who like measuring things less than they like deciding which things not to measure. But when the consumption of a society became the primary source of its wealth, of its increases in wealth, as seen by the economists doing the measuring, then the knowing about consumers became the crucial knowledge in the economy, in the same way that studying the efficiency and improvement of production was the most important form of knowledge and the most important structure of knowledge creation that existed in the previous industrial period, when the production of the economy was the primary source of its increase in wealth. Studying the consumer, becoming the most important study going on in such economies, the consumption-driven economies, it naturally follows that studying the behavior of the consumer becomes the place in which you would like to have the most precision and the most opportunity to know. And the companies that held the pipes that lay closest to the switch, nearest to your eyeball and your eardrum, had at least an advantage, if not a dominant advantage, in studying the consumer, so long, that is, as they were entitled to break bulk, to look inside the packets, to know what it was that Aunt Sally and little Susie were actually talking about and thinking about and doing, using that nervous system of which they now possessed so many of the ganglia and so much of the electrochemical oomph. And looking inside the packet, well, that was, after all, what it was that the people who shipped those packets already got to do. And the people who shipped those packets were the people who were the Googles and the Facebooks and the Twitters and the Instagrams and the Picassas. They were the providers of digital services who provided those services at nominal price in order to have the benefit of seeing all the traffic and storing all the traffic and inferring from all the traffic. They were the ones who said, indeed, it's really so just beautifully, powerfully profitable for us to know what you're doing all the time that, of course, we'd be happy to give you email for $0. And photo sharing for $0, and blogging and microblogging for $0. In fact, there's nothing that computers can be used to do in direct relationship to consumers that we wouldn't at least think about doing at price zero for tons and tons of people, if only we could spy on tons and tons of people. And as that turned out to be a tremendously profitable business, it turned out that the telecommunications companies could, with just a little bit of jiggering, also be in that business too. At least they could be in the profitable parts of that business. As to all that providing email stuff, they didn't want to provide that. There were some over-the-top services that they wanted to provide, but those, again, were services in which the candy was the premium content that they had by that time expensively bought themselves into, in return for the ability to know, which required pretty much the same thing that it required of the platform companies. You needed to have a subscription so that the subscriber was personally known to you. You needed to make a little money off that subscription, which the platform companies largely could forego, in order to offer a narrower range of services than the platforms offered, all of which would be fine, because if you had the subscription and you had identified the endpoint and you had segregated the persons in the household, because you can tell the difference between little Susie who logs in this way and Aunt Sally who logs in that way, once you can do all that, you don't have to provide so many shiny services. You don't need to put as much free cheese out, because you've already got all the people stuck to the mousetrap. As you can see from all the various businesses in transport of packets through digital services, whether they are Uber connected to a sensor vehicle operated by a human being, or whether they are Gmail with just one great big heap of email all sitting behind the same chain link fence waiting for somebody easygoing to come and steal it, or whether they are the one-trick ponies that are Facebook and Twitter. You don't have to have a broad variety of services until you need to stick new people to the platform. Once you have to build new mousetraps, you have to find new cheese. But that wasn't the telecommunication service provider's problem. The telecom service provider's problem had already, solution to that problem had already been created in the 20th century. There was already a subscription called the telephone bill. There was already a unique subscriber ID called the telephone number. And everything would have worked just fine, except back in those days, there wasn't any way to look inside the packet. The law prevented telecommunications companies from listening to telephone calls and making front-running profitable decisions on the basis of what they heard. Instead, the problem of the telecommunications companies was to figure out how to get into the ad business, which is where the money was for the platform companies, and into the data collection business using the harnesses they already had. Partly, of course, what that involved was unification of wireless and wired piping, which is what has largely happened now. For all practical purposes, whether we are talking about the United States, where AT&T and Verizon are the anointed duopolists, and T-Mobile, Sprint, Deutsche Telekom under various fascists, is the permitted third runner, the Chrysler Motors of the deal. Or in other societies, the unification of the wired and the wired networks in the same general corporate framework, thus allowing packets to be inspected and advertising to be generated and put in the packet stream, doesn't actually depend on whether you are the wireless one or the wired one. That's an important form of unification that developed as the convergence occurred. But the attempt to unify the customer subscription with packet movement, whether that is the data plan of the cord cut only has mobile phone young person of the society, or it is the cable to the wall still being used by those who subscribe for television but get their voice communications from their cable subscriber, or the highly converged party who has only a bulk internet connection and who uses it to generate all her own telephony and all her own other forms of communication because she's technically sophisticated and she's shrewd. All of that together in the end ultimately reduces, at least they hope, somewhere to a bill for a monthly fee for connection of one sort or another, and the opportunity thus to identify On the basis of the subscriber and the known information about the subscriber, the meaning of all the packets passing through. You also can try to compete directly with Google and Facebook inside the real estate of the browser by adding your own ads to the traffic passing into the browser and representing, from the point of view of the naive human being, the internet. So who is selling advertising to you will include the people whose search facility you just used to look up what you want to buy, and the telecommunication service provider or pipe owner who also has a switch near you and who sees your browsing going on and who knows what you're looking at and who thereby decides that you ought to receive an ad from them that they sold to somebody else that competes with the advertising competing for your attention. From the point of view of the parasite with the mind of God, this just means having two injector organs stuck into you at the same moment. That this represents competition between Google and Verizon is of absolutely no importance to the parasite. Google is its left hand and Verizon is its right. This relationship to function as internal metabolic organs with the parasite, of the parasite with the mind of God, isn't the ultimate destination of the network, not for those of us who believe that we could still succeed in treating this as our body with our freedom threaded throughout it, belonging to the people, not belonging to the shareholders of this or that. But presuming that the shareholders of this or that, instead of the people, are to be in control of the people's destiny, then the parasite is already in control of the destiny of the companies. Which brings us to the essential irrelevance of the vestigial forms of regulation still in being from the earlier time. When the telecommunications system is the telephone company or companies, and their relationship with national territorial government is that of tax farmers, the regulatory structures that are necessary are those which are about the natural monopoly or the tight oligopoly of telecommunications provision over a provider-owned network and how to regulate those as public utilities. Accordingly, the forms of regulation, whether they're embodied in the U.S. Communications Act of 1927 or they're evolved out of the forms of post-war liberal statist regulation which characterized the European nations whose telecoms were largely rebuilt on the Marshall Plan, or whether they involve the complex forms of imitating capitalism that are the Japanese and Korean relations between manufacturers and government after the Second World War. The fundamental underlying principle is that the lucky holders of the telecommunications gear are indeed to secure immensely anti-competitive pricing. They are to use that to entrench themselves in political power, and they are to be forced to pretend through a form of dramatic regulatory theater that the public controls them because the administrative agencies of government strongly limit their ability to get away with murder. Well, I mean, murder they don't need to commit, as opposed to robbery they do, but nonetheless, so that they can't get away with murder. And accordingly, we have the Federal Communications Commission, and we have MEEC, and this structure proliferates itself out through other developing societies, so that there are ministries of telecommunications in most democratic form and all autocratic form governments. And those ministries of telecommunications achieve a cut of the revenue. In some nations, that sticks also to the hands of the regulators and their families personally. In others, it sticks only to the public trough. But through which the flow of money, which ultimately enters the pockets of the pigs somewhat more equal than other pigs, and leaves behind that which government needs in order to mount the dramatic effort to prove that it is regulating. This isn't an ideal form of organization anywhere, but as with most such 20th century institutions, it was very good at producing a collateral product, a byproduct, maybe even a byproduct pollutant, which we could refer to as telecommunications law. And telecommunications law, like the law encrusting itself around most such structures of regulatory dramatism and public negotiation with private wealth, among those different forms of the wedding of wealth and power which always occurs and can never be stopped, among them, telecommunications law had some of the features common to the breed. It was technically hyper-complex and linguistically impenetrable, and largely the preserve of a coterie of priest specialists who rented themselves out either to God or the devil in alternating quarters. Telecommunications law had the characteristic that one goes into government and makes it harder, and one comes out and sells its knowledge, one's knowledge of its hardness, to the people for which that hardness is merely another layer of face paint on kabuki. The nature of telecommunications law therefore varied infinitely, but its complexity rose with the profitability of practice in it, and which was in itself, because complicated, expensive drama that could only be conducted by specialists, an excellent way of preserving oligopoly by pretending to destroy it. And it featured, naturally, a deeply intimate knowledge of the forms of business activity which the beginning of the 21st century rendered utterly obsolete. This was not accompanied by extraordinary new legislative daring and great new architecture. We were not, in any of the societies of the planet, going through a new, great, new deal. That is to say, many of the reasons that had given rise to the forms of administrative government that characterized themselves, among other things, by telecommunications law, those forms of government were not in growth at the time. The agencies of strong regulatory government were in retreat in favor of the principles of social organization, lately referred to as globalism and also lately seen perishing of the coronavirus. Instead, what developed was a kind of deliberate air gapping in which the old legislation and the old regulatory structures were carefully preserved. And the drama of that form of regulation went on ceaselessly in order to allow, precisely to allow, specifically not to interfere with what was called innovation, which was the rendering of the regulation obsolete and the renegotiation of the power-wealth relationship in new venues without any particular relationship to old rules. Hence, everybody's ministries of telecoms and everybody's FCCs and everybody's MEEC are still in existence, and they continue to do what they always did, and it is continued to be paid for lavishly and to support its specialized bunch of priests. But it's all been changed into a different form of sham because the actualities of the show have really moved somewhere else. Partly to actors who, because they did not conduct communications by wire, weren't part of the regime of the statutes and the permute and the legitimate bailiwick of the dogberries who ran them. Google and the Federal Communications Commission have come to doubtful blows once or twice, and now in the late pre-post-Trump period, it's getting a little bit worse, but truthfully, the commission has always known that its statute didn't give it any power over things like that, and it mostly, therefore, carefully crossed the street and walked on the other side. The American situation wasn't fundamentally different from the situation elsewhere. The European Commission could create for itself a directorate of the Information Society, but the strongest of all its commissioners, Nelly Cruz, spent an awful lot of her time on continental-wide lifting of roaming charges and other useful steps in the direction of some a general principle that it was never in any position to declare. And, the relationship between the Ministry of Telecommunications in Japan and NTT Docomo, it isn't as though when everything has changed, you'll ever stop seeing the same people in the same tea houses for the same purposes. And the fact that what you talk about is an industry transformed into an industry that the legal structures no longer correctly represent is hardly relevant. Power hasn't moved and wealth hasn't either. And the way they flirt and the method of which they marry and the caterers they invite to put on the feast are pretty much all the same, no matter whether what they're doing is so deeply emotionally felt love match or a mariage blanche of the most remote description. So over time, and by time here we now mean years only, things that can be measured in double-digit months, in time, the regulatory structures about telecommunications became instead regulatory structures that constrained people who were only now in the business of telecommunications in the sense that that was the free cheese, and who were really in the business of behavior collection, but who were only some of the people in the business of behavior collection, and they competed and money married power in different marriages in different corners of the mansion, and everybody knew that they were talking about one thing, but they treated it as six or seven. And telecommunications then became one of the misshapen tools, missing one half of its jaw, which is then used with other tools to try and get a grip on a system of behavior collection in which Verizon is a telephone company, and Viacom is a television content company, and Disney is, well, God knows what Disney is, and after all, Google and Instagram, Facebook, and, are unregulated entities, uncovered by the communications rules and subject only to the huff-huffing of the Federal Trade Commission if they don't keep their word in their incomprehensible privacy statements, in which so many words have been used that they could mean anything except certainly not privacy. In other words, the structures of regulation followed the anatomy of the pre-creature, concerned itself with ganglions, and didn't really understand how the nervous system behaved at all. Ostentatiously didn't know how the nervous system behaved at all. Wasn't supposed to know, hadn't jurisdiction over, wasn't organically, statutorily created to know what the nervous system did at all. Every once in a while, as in Korea, some government decided to create a ministry of the internet and the future. But of course, it turned out to have no natural turf, because its ministries of telecommunications and IP promotion and the like, and the oligopolists at Samsung and LG and SK, who actually were the stakeholders in this democratic of all governments, they had no real interest in updating the system of regulatory intervention. They had only a desire for a more efficient relationship with the government they bought and meant to own. And so, even where the boxes on the org chart had been renamed or reconfigured, not knowing what was going on remained the fundamental purpose of the law of telecommunications and the like, whatever it was called. There are some signs from the world in the middle of the epidemic that this might be changing, though it's hard to ascribe any reality to it in a world of political theatrics on top of regulatory theatrics, on top of ostentatiously pretending to understand while actually keeping everybody else mystified, all those layers created from the end of the 20th century till now. But there is some sign, which is largely a consequence of the increasing understanding of the people that something has gone badly wrong with how they're living, and with a sense that large, rich, powerful things are probably somewhere also evil, and therefore with a precondition for some form of political activity, much like Senator Orville Platt considered there to be when he said of the Sherman Act that it was a bill put through by Congress in order to go to the people with a thing called a bill against the trust. In other words, that the performative aspect, the magician's handkerchief value of the system of regulatory intervention being at any given moment proposed by those eager for populist benefit at the expense of big tech, all of this throat clearing going on might in the end turn out to be the prelude to a legislative reconstruction and a re-architecture of what the relationship between government and the nervous system ought to be. But it's unlikely. The reason that I think it's unlikely isn't just some instantiated political pessimism, they always get it wrong, or regulation is bad. I have none of those feelings. Nor even the sense of socialist pessimism which says we always struggle and we almost always lose, though I have a little bit of that myself. That isn't why I think nothing is happening, just show. The reason I think the history up till now is that of show rather than happening is that the conversation is still being conducted without a realistic grasp of what it is that regulation regulates. The Texas Railroad Commission, up in, from the end of the Second World War until the beginning of the 1970s, the Texas Railroad Commission controlled the global price of petroleum. It wasn't the Texas Oil Commission. It was the Texas Railroad Commission with power to set rates for the shipment of oil. But because it had the power to set the rates for the shipment of oil, it controlled a piece of the American petroleum market, which was crucial in the global petroleum market. And so at the end of the day, what the Texas Railroad Commission said was the price of West Texas crude delivered somewhere else in Texas, like, say, shipping facilities in Houston, determined the global price of oil. It's not unheard of in any one of a number of other areas for this structure to prevail. When there isn't a single clear understanding of the activity under regulation, or when the peripheral is treated as the central, administrative government can be seen to work or seen to fail. But it cannot be fixed when it is failing, and it cannot, its corruption cannot be prevented when it is succeeding, because it is indirect, because the people haven't actually got, even through their usual indirect ability to elect office holders who appoint commissioners, the public hasn't any real power to affect that which is of concern. The architecture itself is Rube Goldberg, not merely indirect in its politics or in its technology, but fatally indirect in its law, which has a lot of words, none of which describe the purpose of the thing. Hence, we will know that the post-telecommunications regulatory structures of the 20th, first century, the ones we actually need, we will know that there is even a possibility of their coming into existence when we see that the discussion is about regulating what really matters, which is the collection of behavior. Those who are collecting behavior have to be regulated in that activity, whether they are Verizon and AT&T or they are Google and Facebook shouldn't matter at all. And whether, therefore, they are AT&T, Google, or Instagram, Verizon, that is to say, how ownership reacts by readjusting family properties in order to make richer and poorer the weddings with power in which it plans to engage, all of that dynastic behavior should not matter to the regulators who actually care. It's like the need of revenue law to go past the apparencies of transactions in order to reach their substance. Where the tax collector cannot perforate this wall of shuffling that has been erected by the taxpayer and the ability to get out, their revenue law fails and the government notices that it doesn't collect sufficient taxes. And so it passes another chess move in the structure, which cuts away another bunch of camouflage, and more taxes are paid, and more money moves offshore. Hence, the problem that we face now, and which I have spent 2 weeks trying to bring to clarity, is the problem that we have 20th century structures of dealing with piping companies and switch rental, and what we need is 21st century regulation of behavior collection, in which the processes that are described in the law are the processes of spying on people and remembering everything they did. It will be no surprise to you that the consequence of whatever evolves from that conversation won't be the prohibition on civil spying, the prevention of surveillance capitalism, or at the end of private espionage. You can see in those places where an effort begins that it begins typically with the idea of data protection. We need data protection law, whether we're talking about the European Commission and its parliament, or whether we're talking about the government of India, or Where democracy exists and this conversation begins, it tends to begin in the key of data protection. And so I find myself in my law practice and in my writing, wherever in the world we are discussing these phenomena, I find myself always beginning by saying that I don't like data protection law because it protects data. And what we need is people protection law, which is the usual kind. And when somebody is telling me that we need data protection law, what she's really telling me is we don't need people protection law, and I tend to disagree with her. And this, the data protection aspect, is very useful in showing us the way in which we are preparing to have a social conversation we're not yet ready to get to. To discuss this in terms of surveillance control bothers two sets of people. The businesses that deny that they are spying and the spies who do not want spying to be regulated. Hence, as those of you who are willing to put up with the idea of yet more tedium and therefore who take my course on computers, privacy, and the Constitution in the spring will find, I mean, you can read the second Snowden lecture now and get it over with if you'd rather. The thing that you will find is that it is relatively easy to shape a demand for government about what it ought to do about its own surveillance. But government's attitude about its own surveillance, like government's attitude about spectrum allocation, is ultimately decided in rooms that don't have names, by committees that don't exist, and in which the voters are definitely not invited. In other words, the problem of trying to define a set of legal rules about behavior control, about behavior collection, and resulting social control is that the governments of the world have learned here in the first quarter of the 21st century that this is not only immensely profitable to industry, it's absolutely powerful for government. And whether you're engaged in running the People's Republic of China or a democratic form of the United States of America, government has no desire to deal with the process of its own surveillance in the kind of high-minded, pro-integrity way that the United States of America conducted that discussion in the post-war 20th century. But as I said in the first Snowden lecture, that had to do with the difference between listening at home and listening away. A distinction which in the 21st century, given the anatomy of our network, had ceased to exist. But all of that is for another time. Concentrating ourselves now on the private side of the surveillance structures, government's effort to define behavior collection as a category of human political and economic activity and beginning to control what the private powers may do with their wealth in that connection. Government's attempt in that will only be successful if it is explicitly what government is trying to do. If government is trying to liberalize telecommunications or engage in data protection or even in consumer privacy, government cannot achieve the objective of the re-architecting of regulation. The parties who control the anatomy of the network collect behavior. The parties who centralize what ought to be federated services collect and offer them at price zero, supposedly free, collect behavior. The parties who have any sources of data, like, say, Columbia University running an email system, collect behavior. Everybody collects behavior and everybody and tries to increase engagement because each of these elements, whether they are platform companies or telephone companies or research facilities or office buildings, each of these things become, in the end, organs of an entity which does two things, collects behavior and stimulates engagement. And that entity, the parasite with the mind of God, well, there's no regulation on earth that contains its name. And as many of the kinds of human beings that we call cultures have discovered over the millennia, the God that does not have a name is an unusually powerful God. And if that God is actually the mind of a parasite, then when the law can't name it, can't describe it, can't depict it, then the law is without meaning and therefore without power. And this, on the eve of the great presidential election, is where we are. Talk to you soon.